Greetings and aggravations, my excellent listeners, and welcome to this April 2012 Science News Update. I'm your exhausted host for this new science podcast, Jim Campanella. Besides my usual chronic exhaustion from having small children, it's nearing the end of our semester right now, and my to-do list is getting way out of hand. I have term papers from two classes to grade. I have quizzes from another class to grade. I have an exam from a third class to grade, homework assignments from two classes to grade, a quiz to write, and a last homework assignment to compose for an advanced graduate class in protein biology. I'm training two students in my laboratory at the moment who have not had much luck this semester in their research work, so I have been able to spend a minimal amount of time with them since they have been repeating so many experiments, changing variables to try to get them to work. Of course, the irony is that now that I have suddenly just very small amounts of time to work with them, their experiments start to actually be successful, and I need to spend more time with them teaching them new techniques. I ran out of lecture material 3 weeks early for one of my graduate classes, and I need to write additional lectures for the closing days of this hellish semester. Writing lecture takes about 3 times longer, in this case about 22 hours, than the actual lectures take to give. Oh, and to top it off, I just got a journal article back from review for the second time, which, according to the editors, still needs a massive rewrite, and the editors gave a deadline for the rewrite that I would rather not think about. I have a colleague that once told me that he became an academic because it seemed the best way to get paid and still have huge amounts of time to quote-unquote goof off. At the moment, I am not feeling like my goof-off time is available quite yet. Let's just get on with the science stories so I can get back to slogging through my actual work. The first story of the night suggests a major breakthrough in reproductive science, and perhaps implies some major social changes as well. Dr. Jonathan Tilley from Massachusetts General Hospital and his colleagues reported February 26th in Nature Medicine a new finding in our understanding of overproduction in mouse and human females. As you all know, it's been sacred medical dogma and pretty much a fact of life that women are born with a certain number of eggs, a few million, and the eggs age and are not replenished as the woman herself ages. She reaches menopause, and that's the end of reproduction as the eggs run out, so to speak. Well, Tilley has discovered that ovaries have stem cells that are present and replenish the eggs at, well, at least a detectable level. Tilley's original research sought to examine menopause and try to track the death of ova as they age. When his group counted the number of healthy egg cells in mouse ovaries, they saw a steady decline as the mice aged, as you would expect. But they also found that for some unexplainable reason, the dying cells greatly outnumbered the starting population of cells. In short, there were more eggs than the mouse started with. Tilley stated in his paper, quote, "What we had was a math problem. We refocused all of our efforts on this glaring mathematical dilemma," unquote. It turns out that there are more dying eggs than healthy ones because stem cells in mouse ovaries are constantly making more eggs, which then die off. That discovery was not exactly welcomed by reproductive biologists. Tilley states that few of his colleagues accepted the results since there was no previous evidence for any process of replenishment in mammalian ovaries. Even the ones who did believe Tilley did not believe that humans would have similar stem cells to those that were found in mice. Tilley was able to quiet the doubters on both sides with work in his recent paper, where he describes how they finally isolated stem cells from human ovaries that had been removed from 6 women during sex reassignment surgeries in Japan. There are not a lot of stem cells in an ovary. Tilley found that only about 1.5% of cells in the ovaries fit the stem cell profile. The researchers compiled molecular profiles of the cells and demonstrated that the stem cells are able to make precursors to eggs when transplanted into other ovaries. Even though Tilley has clearly shown that these cells exist and are active, there are still those who do not support his conclusions, saying that just because he has isolated the stem cells does not mean that they can be manipulated in any helpful or useful way. The cells may not be able to develop into viable adult ova. Despite the skeptics, Tilley still insists that he has made a major discovery that could help millions of women around the world. Quote, stopping the depletion of eggs or keeping ovaries functioning could help stave off many of the health problems women experience after menopause. If we can somehow control the biological clock, to me, the possibilities are endless. Unquote. The next story from the March 15th issue of the journal Scientific Reports is an update on cell phones and their nasty potential effects. At this point, there's still little evidence that cell phones cause cancer, which is a good thing, which everyone should plainly be happy about. However, you may remember months ago that we reported a story that suggested that even though cell phone radiation does not cause cancer, it may have more subtle effects by changing enzymatic pathways while the signal is being broadcast, that is, while the phone is actually on. That paper showed pretty clearly that an active cell phone was able to turn on and alter cellular pathways in the brain. At the time, there did not appear to be any bad outcomes from those cellular changes, but this new paper from reproductive endocrinologist Dr. Hugh Taylor of Yale Medical School may have finally found a nasty consequence. Taylor rigged up cell phones to pregnant mouse cages. Half the phones were actively receiving a call on mute for the entirety of the mice pregnancies, which last about 17 days. I would not want to be paying for this fellow's minutes. The other phones were left inactive. On average, pups from the mothers exposed to cell phone radiation performed worse on memory tests, were more active, and less anxious than pups who were not exposed to the cell phone radiation. Nerve signaling in the prefrontal cortex, that's the main reasoning part of the brain, was also dampened in those exposed mice. In his report, Taylor suggested that the behavioral and brain defects are similar to those seen in people with ADHD, attention deficit hyperactivity disorder. He speculated that increased cell phone use could elucidate why we are seeing an increase in ADHD in our children. This conclusion was not widely accepted by scientists. They argued that it's premature to translate the findings from mice to humans. And doubters say they are even unsure whether the affected pups actually even have a homologue of ADHD. Finally, they state that human fetuses have more protective amniotic fluid around them than mice do, so the cell phone exposure may have fewer ramifications than Taylor insists. Although they do not have faith in Taylor's conclusions, even the skeptics still agree that pregnant women should avoid carrying a cell phone near the abdomen, just in case. Taylor, who refuses to back down on his findings, states, quote, I don't want to sensationalize this or cause panic, but I think it's worth being cautious, unquote. The next story is kind of interesting for anyone who has trouble getting motivated to exercise. It appears that humans evolved with a reward system for actually getting up and moving our butts, but that reward system seems to have been largely forgotten by everyone except possibly marathon runners, because humans are now pretty bloody sedentary to what we once were. Well, what am I driveling about? Dr. David Raiklin of the University of Arizona has published a paper this month in the Journal of Experimental Biology that suggests if we actually became more active, perhaps humans might be mentally happier and not quite so prone to depression. Raiklin explains that our ancient hunter-gatherer kin were long-distance endurance athletes. He says, quote, aerobic activity has played a role in the evolution of lots of different systems in the human body, which may explain why aerobic exercise seems to be so good for us, unquote. He further points out that testing the hypothesis that we evolved for high endurance performance is a problem, because most other mammalian endurance athletes are quadrupedal, four-footed, and didn't evolve on two legs. So he says, quote, we got interested in the brain as a way to look at whether or not evolution stimulated exercise behavior in humans through motivation pathways, unquote. Well, it turns out that that's exactly what the brain did. Most human athletes experience the infamous runner's high after great exertion. That high exists and is caused by endocannabinoid signaling in the so-called reward centers of the brain. For several decades, it was wondered exactly why we had cannabinoid receptors at all in our brains. Cannabinoids are the active ingredient in marijuana, the THC. It was wondered why anyone would have these, Well, it turns out that we have natural cannabinoids that are produced by our brain. Raiklin says that this reward system was able to evolve, becoming more potent in mice as they increased their exercise levels over generations. However, little was known about the role of endocannabinoids in the other aerobically active mammals. So Raiklin and his cohort decided to find out how exercise influenced the endocannabinoid levels of two mammalian natural athletes, humans and dogs, and one species that is not much of an athlete, the ferret. Raiklin and his company recruited humans and pet dogs from around Arizona. The researchers then trained the participants to run and walk on a treadmill and collected blood samples from them before and after exercise. Now, surprisingly, when they started the ferret work, they found that ferrets are not as agreeable as humans and dogs. They had to wait until the ferrets wanted to exercise, which became quite a tedious task, as you might imagine. After finally getting all the blood samples, they analyzed the endocannabinoid levels and found that the concentrations of one cannabinoid had rocketed in the blood of the dogs and humans after a brisk run. When the team tested the human runner's state of mind, they found that the athletes were much happier after exercise. However, when the team analyzed the ferret's blood samples, the animal's cannabinoid levels did not increase during exercise. They did not produce those brain chemicals in response to high-intensity exercise, in short. Those results led Raiklin to suggest that natural selection used the endocannabinoid system as a stimulation for endurance exercise in humans and other animals that walk and run over long distances. In short, exercise and you will be happy. That old saw about how good it is to quote-unquote feel the burn is actually accurate if our brain has anything to say about it. Raiklin says, quote, "These results suggest that natural selection may have been motivating higher rather than low-intensity activities in groups of mammals that evolved to engage in these types of aerobic activities," unquote. Additionally, Raiklin suggests that the present crisis in humans who have chronic depression may spring directly from our lack of exercise. We evolve for exercise and to be amazing athletes. And now, let's face it, we are pretty much couch potatoes. Raiklin suggests that our own cannabinoids are probably a silver bullet to solve not just the depression problem, but the obesity problem as well. Exercise, get happy, get thin. So, wow, makes you want to jump up and do several miles of running to get that high, huh? Well, go easy, boys and girls. Nothing's ever that simple. Raiklin states, quote, "Couch potatoes are not about to leap suddenly out of their comfy chairs and experience the pleasurable effects of exercise, because they probably cannot produce enough endocannabinoids. Inactive people may not be fit enough to hit the exercise intensity that leads to this sort of rewarding sensation," unquote. In short, you may kill yourself if you try to run or exercise enough to actually get a high, if you are not in shape already. Wow, that's a serious bummer. But there still is hope. In the paper, Raiklin says that he is optimistic that inactive individuals can be helped to build up their exercise tolerance until they can cross the threshold where they can become motivated to exercise by endocannabinoids. So you may yet feel better if you are overweight and depressed. What about if you're overweight, depressed, and bald as well? Is there any hope for you? Well, according to Dr. George Katsourelis of the University of Pennsylvania, yes, there may be hope for the hair follicle impaired yet. He reported some new research on hair growth in the March 21st issue of the journal Science Translational Medicine. Katsourelis had previously found that bald men still have hair follicle stem cells. They are not lost as the men age and go bald, but those cells are simply no longer active in the bald areas of the head. He hypothesized that either the stem cells lacked growth stimuli, or there is some sort of inhibitor being made that prevented the cells from growing. To find out which hypothesis was correct, his team analyzed gene activity in scalp samples taken from men undergoing hair transplant procedures. They found 81 genes with higher activity in bald areas of the head compared with those covered in hair. After analyzing which genes might be important, Katsourelis decided that ones connected with hormones were probably the most important. Among those hormone-interactive genes was the one that makes prostaglandin D2. Katsarelis hypothesized that prostaglandin might be holding back hair growth. Oddly enough, earlier research had previously suggested that a different prostaglandin called F2 actually stimulates the growth of eyelashes. Katsarelis states that, quote, prostaglandins often have a yin and a yang. One prostaglandin may stimulate hair growth, but another might stop it, unquote. In his new study just reported, he actually found evidence that prostaglandin type D2 inhibited hair growth in human hair follicles in the laboratory. Additionally, mice treated with the D2 slowed their hair growth when it was applied to their skin. Furthermore, when they genetically engineered mice to overproduce prostaglandin D2 in their skin, the mice went bald. Prostaglandin D2 works in the skin stem cells through a protein called GPR44. That protein sets off a biochemical cascade reaction when it detects the presence of prostaglandin D2. Hair growth in mice where GPR44 was no longer made was not inhibited by prostaglandin D2. And yes, if you're thinking that's a good thing, you're right. That result suggests that drugs that block GPR44 might actually help to treat baldness. However, be patient a bit longer because there is always a caveat with these things. One caveat is that no one yet understands how all the different prostaglandins interact, so you don't want to go inhibiting one before you know exactly what it will do to the others. Additionally, there's some evidence to suggest, and this is mainly from the studies of minoxidil, the hair growth medicine, that stimulating prostaglandins may also induce hair growth. It may be that hair growth is not simply controlled by one or two prostaglandins, but by a balance between competing prostaglandins and not just inhibiting one. So again, be patient, but hope certainly seems to be around the corner if you wait a bit longer. We will finish the night with an answer to a question that my son asked me while watching an episode of the kids' show, Busy Town Mysteries. For those of you not familiar with this animated show, let me explain that it's a very simple mystery show in which animated animals, primarily an uncharacterized mammal of some kind named Huckle, who might be some species of cat, look for clues and solve mysteries around their town. It's a cute, brightly colored show that encourages kids to solve puzzles by answering the who, what, where, and whys of a situation. At any rate, in this particular mystery, there were a series of holes over a doorway that the investigating animals found were placed there by a woodpecker. Eventually, the culprit was observed pecking at a tree and looking for insects for his dinner. My not-quite-4-year-old son asked how the woodpecker can bang its head on a wall or tree and not hurt itself. I considered this a moment and finally admitted that I had no idea. Certainly head injuries are a serious issue for mammals. Head trauma has become a major problem over the last few years with athletes and soldiers constantly being injured. Obviously, even if you don't get a limb blown off by an IED, your skull may be seriously injured by the shock compression wave of the nearby explosion. This has become far too commonplace in the last 10 years. And also, certainly, football players are not safe, and boxers get punch drunk after years of fighting because their brains have been bounced around on the insides of their skulls so much. So why are woodpeckers immune to this violence? Well, this month in the journal PLOS ONE, Dr. Liz Hen Wang of Beihang University and her colleagues may finally have an answer for my son. Wang and her group analyzed the movements and detailed anatomical features of great spotted woodpeckers. They initially used high-speed cameras to record the movements of the woodpeckers, who pecked at a sensor that recorded their force. Wang found that the pecking speeds were pretty fast, at about 7 meters per second, and that there was a great deal of deceleration at impact. Wang then did brain scans of the woodpecker skulls to examine the bone structures there. She also mechanically tested specimens of bone to obtain the exact mechanical properties of that tissue. Finally, putting all her data together, she came up with a computer model of the woodpecker's head that could simulate the motions and impacts that the bird experienced. She then took her model and modified various anatomical features, such as beak length, to examine the effects these had on how the force is transferred at impact. Apparently, there's no one factor that protects the woodpecker, but sort of a constellation of several factors. First, the researchers concluded that an uneven distribution of spongy bone, primarily at the forehead, may play a role in shock absorption. Second, they suggested that the bird's hyoid apparatus, that's the cartilage and bone structure in the woodpecker's nasal cavity, may act as a sort of safety belt for the head, absorbing shocks and bearing high stress as the brain gets moved around inside their skulls. Finally, third, from the 3D computer model, the researchers found that the outer tissue layer of the upper beak is longer than it is on the bottom, but that the bone structure is longer on the bottom than it is on the top. And what exactly does that mean from a functional standpoint? Well, the researchers think that those unequal lengths may allow impact to be distributed away from the brain via the lower beak, so that the brain is less affected by all that banging around. I was a bit bemused to see that the paper suggested as one of its goals to create, quote, woodpecker-inspired safety devices, unquote, to keep us safe from impacts. I guess that as silly as that sounds, it may kind of make sense. Certainly a better understanding of the material properties and distribution of the shock-absorbing spongy bone can be incorporated into the design of new safety helmets to make them safer. As a parent, I know that I would appreciate any apparatus to make my kids less prone to injuring themselves. Perhaps the woodpecker actually has the secret to surviving all those nasty impacts and tumbles that may hurt so many. Well, that's all from me for now. As always, take care, keep those cell phones away from your gonads, and I hope I've inspired some of you. Until next time, this is Jim Campanella.